Let me give a couple of preliminary comments on this. This is not a course in marriage, though today, and perhaps even a little bit beyond, I'll be talking about marriage. There's no way to talk about divorce and remarriage without first discussing the question of marriage. And not in depth and not exhaustively, but at least certain principles about the question of marriage, as the Bible speaks to that that whole area, as a necessary backdrop for the discussion of divorce and remarriage. As far as this discussion, the discussion of and the concern of this course goes, I know a few questions that are more vexed among God's people today. That doesn't mean, therefore, that you're going to have all of your problems ironed out in 12 hours or less, or that I'm going to have all the answers to all of those questions that you might ask. I think that I have a sufficient number of answers which may be pulled together into some kind of order and some kind of form, though at this point it could use a little more of that, I confess, because it is so preliminary in some respects. And I hope that somehow or other I can share these insights, if indeed they turn out to be that, with the rest of you for the benefit of Christ's church. But one thing is sure, we have had very little teaching in the Church of Jesus Christ on this subject. The reason that I gave you such a brief bibliography is because, in my opinion, that's about it. The subject, of course, is discussed by other people, and it is discussed in many places in small ways in passing, in commentaries and principles of Christian living or ethics or some other place. But basically, this question has been a mooted question in the Church of Jesus Christ, and we have been left to flounder. Now, there was a reason why that could happen. 25 or 26 years ago, when I began my ministry officially, nobody really taught anything about marriage to speak of, or taught anything about divorce, or taught anything about remarriage, though a passing sermon here or there might refer to it because the man was doing some kind of book study and he had to deal with Matthew 5 or Matthew 19, 1 Corinthians 7 or something of that sort. And that's about all that you got on the subject. A book here or there, a commentary as you read through, you'd run into some discussion, not very much in depth, and usually avoiding or coming right up to all the critical questions you'd like to have answered and then going right around them and continuing on, as a number of commentaries commentators love to do. But there just weren't any definitive works on the subject, and we're still almost without any, except for this great classic of Murray's that I suggested. And we were even bereft 25 years ago of works on marriage that were of any real depth, or works on the family. There were a few more of these, but they still did not go into the question in the depth in which you might find books on that subject today. Of course, you can turn to any Christian bookstore today and find a zillion books on marriage, most of which you don't want to read, but there are a number of good ones. And there are useful works on that subject and useful works on the subject of the family. But back in those pristine years, when we were in our first days of evangelical struggle with liberalism and we're losing all the battles, all the main schools were going down the tubes, all the main institutions in this country had been captured in the 30s and 20s and 30s by the liberals. The evolutionists were on top. The conservatives had been thrown out of their churches and were meeting in storefronts, and the battles were on every other hand. It was those kinds of issues that were taking the minds and the time and the thought and the concern of conservative and evangelical commentators and writers. There were very few books published to begin with. because you just had such a small market because conservatives were in such a tremendous minority, to say it the wrong way, but to emphasize it perhaps that way. And the liberals had control of all the airwaves. They had control of, wasn't any television to speak of yet. They had control of all the book companies. They had control of everything under the sun. And conservatives were hanging on by their toenails, and many of whom were dispensationalists who were saying, if we can just hang on for another half second, then the Lord will come, so let's not worry about Christian living or anything else. Let's just hang on. And this was the kind of attitude that was going on, that was prevalent in those days. There just wasn't time, energy, or resources to produce much of this. And while that doesn't excuse the church for not having found ways to do this, there was a whole generation of people, my generation, who grew up with literally no pastoral counseling, who grew up with no books to tell you how to run your marriage, and we had to stumble through all the wrong things and dig into the scriptures and find out some answers on our own, having found all of these things out the hard way first. You live in a different period entirely. The Church of Jesus Christ has changed its flavor world round. Not only are conservatives in the majority today and have all the resources and are burgeoning ahead and the seminaries are choke full of people and that kind of thing, but the books abound and you have to wade through to see what it is out of every 6,000 evangelical titles that will appear this year that you want to buy and put on your library. There's a glut of material, and so it's an entirely different era. But still, even in that condition, which has changed, there have been relatively few books on the subject of divorce and remarriage. And I think you'll realize that. There have been some. And there have been some subjects on divorce by people who have been through it, divorced and still a Christian kind of thing, and telling you all about the struggles and the heartaches and the sorrows and that kind of thing, which is all useful, but still not doing the exegetical job and the theological job and the systematic job that you need to do in order to use it as pastors, to use the scriptural principles as pastors in a way that will be satisfying to those whom you counsel. Now, even the marriage questions are still vexed among many Christians today as a result of the fact that most of the books that are coming out on marriage and family are written from a devotional or superficial viewpoint rather than from an exegetical viewpoint, or are written from an eclectic viewpoint in which a lot of psychology is thrown into the Bible, and then, eureka, look what's in the Bible, it just agrees with Freud and Jung or Bruno Bettelheim or somebody else. And this kind of thing comes along, you see, and we get that kind of eclectic psychologizing of the scriptures rather than exegetical work in the scriptures to discover what it is that God has to say about the family and marriage questions. So what I'm trying to say to you today is simply this. There still needs to be a lot of work done, and that's why this course is important. Now, there's another reason why this course is important, because there was once a time when the church thought it could. I don't believe it ever really could. I think that's one of the reasons we're in the soup in a lot of places today as a church. But it thought it could get away with not discussing the question of marriage in depth and not discussing the question of divorce and remarriage in depth, because, first, the state and all of the institutions of our society were on the side of the family. There was a time when everybody said motherhood and apple pie and the American flag are good. There was not a time when people were burning, it was not a day when people were burning the American flag, questioning the value of apple pie, and that one I still haven't heard yet, but at least really ripping up the concept of marriage and the family and saying, do we really need this institution? Or was it something that developed out of the cave where Og and Bog sat around a fire in the middle of the night one day, and as they sat there and scratched and philosophized with one another, Og said to Bog, you know, Og, I believe that all the kids back there and who are asleep in the back of this cave are your kids. And Bog said, oh, no, they're your kids, Og. And Og said, no, they're your kids. And they get into this big fight about whose kids are whose, and that one of them has to go out and conk the dinosaurs on the head and bring home all the dinosaur steaks while the other one's producing all the kids, and this isn't fair. And so they finally decide, look, we're going to develop an institution called marriage, whatever they first called it, so that we can sort out responsibility. Now, a lot of people, not exactly with that format as you gather, but a lot of people in high schools and college and elsewhere today are teaching our young people that that's how marriage began, as something that human beings, by convenience, developed in a day in which we were naive about means of contraception. But now that we have the pill, now that we can work things out by abortion and everybody accepts it, if the pill doesn't happen to work, or we have the morning after, the night before pill, or whatever comes next with some kind of electric therapy to kill kids or something, I would say that this is no longer necessary, many teachers are teaching, or I would at least question whether this institution of marriage and the family is necessary. And so we have our educational institutions, our medical institutions, in many cases liberal theologians and others, all of whom at one time in this society, back when I was a young and budding seminarian, were supporting the institution of family and the marriage, at least vocally. If they did other things on the side, that was their own business, but everybody would look down on this because it was the ethos of the day to support the family and to support marriage. And so it was easy for the Christian church to say, well, you don't have to discuss the question of marriage. There's no antithesis. All of society agrees, at least in our Western culture in America, that the family is a good thing, and the police department supports it and helps families get back together and all that kind of thing. And so all the institutions of society were in favor of marriage. Now even the police department doesn't do it because they have to watch out for the Miranda law, and by the time they've gone through that, the husband has already been conked over the head with a rolling pin. And so all these things, you see, are problems for our society in our day, which did not exist back there even as long ago as when I began coming up in these ranks. Now, you see, we have a new situation demanding that we rediscuss the family, that we rediscuss marriage with our children, because if we don't discuss the basic principles and the fundamentals of marriage and the fundamentals of this issue, then the world outside is going to have its licks at our kids through all the means that are so subtle and yet so effective in pouring those abysmal concepts into their ears from the billboards, from the television programs that now emphasize the single-parent family where divorce is respectable and everything about it is fine and lovely, and all the rest of the influences that are leveling all kinds of values in our society so that you no longer hold to values, and you live and let live and follow your feelings, which is the whole ethos of our time. If it feels good, do it. And, of course, that's what's happening. And you can no longer look to society to support Christian values, even in a titular way, as it once did, though it never really did in any sense whatever. Now, I say the church never should have looked to society to do it. But it was a temptation to do so. It was easier to do so. The church did do so. And when it was occupied with other issues, fighting liberalism just for survival, as she invaded his churches and took over the denominations and took over the institutions and the rest of it, and fighting the issues of evolution and everything else that were on hand in those days and all this, it was easy in those days when there were few people losing the battle with little resources left. It was easy to neglect such issues when you saw a kind of support all around you in society, and so who's fighting it? Why should I bother to teach it? Was something of the attitude, though not articulated that way, not even consciously thought through that way in most instances. But that was a circumstance. Also, in those days, back there, as far as I can remember, and I speak out of my own experience because I don't know much about anybody else's experience in any depth, but I know full well that most of the churches that I had anything to do with or that I knew anything about, and I believe that this will be borne out by other people to whom I have spoken who are of the same vintage that I am, whose hair on their beard still remained a little darker longer, will say to you that most of the churches simply didn't deal with the question of divorce and remarriage, because it was virtually an unheard of thing in the Church of Jesus Christ if it was an evangelical church or a conservative church. And so you could close your eyes to the subject. There weren't that many converts to begin with, so that you had a bunch of people who were already divorced and remarried that you had a handle. Converts were few and far between. Your own people wouldn't get divorced for anything, because the pressure of society still was against divorce, and the church society, the subculture of the Church of Jesus Christ, the evangelical church, was so strongly against it that you held on no matter what. And it was only in those rare cases where somebody committed adultery and took off and wouldn't be reconciled or something of the sort that a divorce ever took place. And everybody then developed the line of the innocent party and the guilty party thing. And that was simple and easy enough to deal with. But you still were a little askance even about that guy. I wonder how much he participated in it. But the church just simply refused to get involved. It took its hands off for the most part. There were notable exceptions here or there in particular churches with particular pastors. But for the most part, the question was ignored. It was avoided. And it was easy to do so because the number of incidents were few. The people who got wrecked, the few who got wrecked along the way, who were not cared for and who were not counseled and who were not dealt with biblically, went down in flames, somehow or other survived, if they did, or just wandered away disillusioned and confused. Many people were kept out of office as a result of this. Many people were not dealt with properly who had the gift to serve Jesus Christ, who couldn't even sing in choirs, were reluctantly allowed to get into the church at all as second-class citizens. But you never remarried a divorced person. That was heinous. You just didn't get involved. I just simply don't marry divorced persons. I'll even ask questions about how, when, why, how, where, or what, many a pastor would say to you. And that was the attitude. And it still persists in a number of evangelical pockets today. So, that's kind of the background as to how we got to where we are. Well, where are we? We're in a day in which all the values are thrown up in the air and are coming down like tossed salad. And I like that kind of a day in one respect. I don't like it in a number of respects, but I do like it in one respect. It forces the Church of Jesus Christ to rethink issues biblically. It doesn't allow us to coast on the merits of the past. It doesn't allow us simply to ignore and take hands off and to back off and say, I'm not going to touch this or I can avoid this. Listen, whatever you think of Campus Crusade and other organizations like that, they have won so many people to the Lord, or at least so many people who say they've been won to the Lord. Not all of them, I suppose, are converts. Billy Graham has his converts and supposed converts, too. And they come flooding into the church, and a whole scat of them have been divorced. And a whole scat of them have been remarried or want to get remarried. And the church can't avoid it anymore, and I like that. Now, I don't like the fact that there's so many people divorced and all that kind of thing, but I like the fact the church has to face issues that it should have faced long ago, and it wasn't prepared to face when it did come flooding in. But I like the fact that it's got to face it at least now. Now, we're late. We're coming too late with too little. And by the time you get out there and do something about it, you're going to find you're going to have still an awful lot of hard struggles with people who are not going to hear you because they're still thinking in the old mentalities. And they've been trained and raised up in the old mentalities, and they're still askance. But there are an awful lot of other people out there who want to know. And the church is changing because I think there are lots and lots and lots of evangelical and Bible-believing Christians today of various stamps who really want to know what the Scriptures say on these issues, but they're not getting satisfying answers. That's why this course, because it is counseling today. And when I think about counseling today, biblical counseling today, this is one of the main issues that comes to my mind as a topic that we ought to be dealing with today, because it is so pertinent. We can no longer sit back and ignore. We can no longer take the obscurantist viewpoint. We've got to go through the problems. We can't go under them. We can't go around them. We can't go over them. We've got to go through them. And that forces us back to the Scriptures to see what God says about these issues in a new and fresh way. Now, to begin with, then, we're going to discuss the question of marriage. Because marriage and some of its principles, at least some of the basics about marriage, is an absolute precondition for understanding divorce. Divorce being, and I'm not giving a technical definition of it at this point, we'll get into that more later on, but being the dissolution of marriage, then we certainly have to understand what it is that this divorce dissolves. And remarriage involving a person again, but in a new way in that state of marriage, certainly again demands that we understand something about the positive side of things. So that's why we're going to take time at first to deal with some principles of marriage and lay those as a foundation for taking off on these other two subjects later on. Marriage is not a human invention, according to the Og and Bog theme or any other theme. That's the first principle that I think we must stand steadfastly upon, that we must stress and emphasize everywhere that we go, that we must make a foundational principle with our young people, because they will be taught by every medium otherwise. Marriage was an institution that God Himself ordained. It is not a humanly invented, a humanly devised institution, but a divinely given institution. And secondly, along with that, I think we ought to emphasize that marriage is a foundational institution, that it is one of the very foundation stones upon which the very society in which we live and the sub-society called the church in which we live rests. Apart from marriage, there is no covenantal relationship in the Church of Jesus Christ, and there is no relationship even in society among individuals that could be lasting and satisfying and that would keep down confusion and chaos. Marriage is the first and most foundational institution, in one sense, of all. Before there was a church organized, there was a church in embryo and an unorganized form, of course, in the garden. Before there was a church, there was an organized marriage institution, one that was explicitly set forth as such. The church was not explicitly, definitively set forth as such in the garden. It was there because there was God and there were men. But marriage was explicitly instituted by God in the garden. Before there was an educational institution, there was marriage, the institution of marriage. Before there was a business organization, there was the institution of marriage. Before there was a governmental institution, as far as human government goes, God, of course, was governing all things and continues to do so. There was a human, but divinely given human institution of marriage explicitly set forth as such. The first and most foundational institution is marriage. And for people to challenge, as they indeed do in so many ways today, the foundational nature of marriage is to challenge the very basis and structure of our society as we have known it in Western civilization. So we're in a very interesting period in which that's being done, and if we do not teach our people, and especially our young people who are coming along, these facts about marriage, they will be taught the opposite, you can be sure. Now, the interesting thing about marriage that we need to understand is that it is not what the Roman Catholic Church claims that it is and what so many Protestants have also accepted as what marriage is. Marriage is not first and foremost or fundamentally a sexual union. It is not, I said, a sexual union first and foremost. It involves sexual union as an obligation, and a very central obligation, a very prominent obligation, But marriage itself is something different from, bigger than, and inclusive of not only the sexual relationship, but other relationships as well. So that it is something different from a mere sexual union. Otherwise, the Bible would not speak about illicit sexual intercourse. It would speak about informal marriages or something of that sort. But the Bible makes a clear distinction between illicit sexual intercourse between human beings who are not married and sexual intercourse among human beings who are married. And it does not say, it does not call those relationships which are illicit among unmarried persons marriages. It calls them adultery, fornication, whatever you want to use. But sexual sin is what we shall see that the word fornication really means when we get into that question later on. So that we must distinguish these two things. The Roman Catholic Church has always taught that marriage is, if the purpose of marriage is to propagate the human race. That is not true according to Scripture. That is a sub-purpose of marriage, but not the fundamental issue in marriage, not the major reason for marriage, not the basic thing that the Bible sets forth as the critical issue that brought about this institution in the first place. Indeed, if marriage were needed in order to propagate the human race, then man would be the strangest of all God's creatures. Because all of the rest of the animals, including dogs, cats, goats, and the rest, are able to propagate their races apart from marriage. You see, mating and marriage are not to be equated. Mating is one thing, but marriage is something different. Marriage is something bigger that includes mating, but it is not to be equated with or identified with mating. Mating is quite adequate for propagating the human race without marriage. If that were the only purpose for marriage, then we might very well dispense with it, because human beings could be quite prolific and probably would be even more prolific as far as this is concerned if they did not have the institution of marriage. If promiscuous mating were the rule in our society, as it is often among the animals of our society, then, of course, we probably have far more kids than we do now around the human race to be propagated much more adequately. So we must distinguish between these two things. What then is the reason for marriage? Well, I want to wait a little bit in answering that question, and I want to investigate just a little bit more fully this matter of the sexual union. Though we so easily right now say together, all sexual relationships do not constitute marriage, when we get to the question of divorce, we so often change our tune. And we start saying, all these people have a sexual relationship and that has dissolved marriage. This adulterous relationship has dissolved marriage. But it hasn't. I have heard people say, well, it's dissolved in God's sight, and so we better dissolve it in man's sight, because the marriage began when the two had sexual relations and sexual union on their first marriage day, and now it disappears informally because there has been an adulterous relationship contracted. This is not true. The union between those two people sexually did not begin their marriage. And the union between one of those married partners and someone outside of the marriage relationship does not dissolve their marriage. And we need to see that most clearly and plainly to begin with. Marriage is bigger than, though it is inclusive of, it is bigger than sexual union. And so it cannot be dissolved automatically by adultery. And it cannot be instituted by proper sexual relations. It is instituted, when it is instituted correctly, prior to proper sexual relations, and therefore authorizes proper sexual relations. But marriage is something different from and bigger than and distinct from the sexual union itself. And that I want you to get plainly in your mind, and I'm going to develop it more fully in 5 minutes after we come back for our break. Now, I've been saying that since sexual union does not constitute marriage, and adultery and illicit sexual union among married persons does not break it, we must then discover the essence of marriage in something else. It must be somewhere else. It must be bigger if it's comprehensive of sexual union, but not identical to it. What is the very fundamental issue in marriage? Why marriage? And the answer to that is given to us clearly in the Scriptures. We have no question when we read the Scriptures and stop philosophizing and stop using our own skulls about this question. The Scriptures say explicitly in Genesis 2:18, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a suitable helper, completing him." In other words, the reason for marriage, the very fundamental issue in this institution, is to fight the problem of loneliness. Marriage was instituted to solve that problem. It is not good that man should be alone can be clearly set forth by seminary students by simply going the rounds of single seminary student dorms. By all of your senses, sight, smell, touch, all the rest of the senses, you can determine that this is true. But there are other factors involved, of course. But it is not good, is God's basic rule for most people. Now, there are exceptions to that rule, and we had better talk about those exceptions right at this point. There are some people whom we might say God has singled out. Well, that's one way to say it. You think of a better one. You can laugh, but come up with some alternative, you know. That God has singled out for the life of celibacy. And we read about those people in Matthew 19, where in clear words, Jesus discusses that issue in a way that perhaps is not discussed as fully anywhere else in the Scriptures. That was after the discussion of divorce that ran from verse 3 through verse 9, where Jesus ended by saying that there was only one reason that God accepted as legitimate for divorce, namely fornication. And then the disciples in verse 10 said to him, "If that's the way that it must be between a man and his wife, it would be better not to marry." Now, it's not in the text because the Greeks didn't have a word for it. But that was their attitude. That was surely their attitude. They said, "Wow! If that's the way things are, then, man, it's better not to get involved." Of course, Paul makes it clear in 1 Corinthians 9 that all of them backtracked on that statement because he says that all the apostles got married. But this was in their early days of thinking through the issue, at least, when they still hadn't decided, I suppose, whether they had the gift of celibacy or not. And that was their response, "Man, it might be better than not to get involved in this thing. If once you're in it, this is the only door out. You're taking a tremendous risk." Then Jesus went on to say these words, which have to do with that single life. He said in verses 11 and 12, Not everybody has the capacity for that, but only those to whom it has been given. There are eunuchs who were born that way. There are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs who make themselves eunuchs for the sake of the empire from the heavens. Whoever has the capacity must exercise it. Now, there are three ways that people become eunuchs. Some are born that way, they're physically defective by birth. There are some who have been made eunuchs after birth by their fellow men for various reasons. Some were naturally eunuchs, some were unnaturally eunuchs by castration. And then it says there are some who make themselves eunuchs. We might say they are eunuchs supernaturally or by divine call and gifting. Now, they make themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom or the empire from the heavens. And whoever has this gift or this capacity must exercise it. In other words, God singles out certain people to do peculiar works in his kingdom that can only be done by celibates. And they are singled out in a peculiar way for the sake of his kingdom. And I think that it's time that we started saying that to a lot of people who question, why am I not married? What about my life? Has God passed me by? Isn't there somebody for me? We should say to them, whoa! Before you start complaining and before you start asking those questions, start asking the first question. Are you one of that special group of persons that God has singled out for the single life? Has he given to you a gift that you're not exercising, and has he put you in a position where you could serve peculiarly in his kingdom, and has he singled you out for the sake of that kingdom, and are you sitting around and grousing instead of working in this kingdom? And I believe that there are an awful lot of people who are in that position today who are grousing rather than growing. And it's time that we challenge them with this possibility. Now, not all of those persons who are without husbands or are without wives are in that situation by any means. But there are a number of people, I think, who miss their call and who do not recognize their gift and who thereby are wasting their lives, and could be really fulfilling those lives in a joyous and productive way for great blessing, not only to themselves, but first of all to others and for the propagation of the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And we need to face people with that possibility. I think every single person needs to face that as a possibility. Now, it's not the rule, it's the exception, you understand. Not everybody has that capacity. Only those to whom it has been given, says Jesus. It's a special gift, a special capacity, something that he has given to special people. And they are a special group. And they ought to be honored as such, it seems to me. I don't mean put uniforms on them, but I mean we ought not to look down on such people as sometimes is done in the Christian church. Rather, we ought to respect and look up to them for the special calling that God has given to them that he has not always given to the rest of us clods who are in the average and general situation. Paul was one of those special people, presumably. And we kind of look up to him. We don't look down on him because he wasn't married. Now, I know he may have been married at one point and not later on and all that kind of thing, but we don't really have any evidence of it. And we know that he wasn't married when he wrote 1 Corinthians 7. And the point is, and also the rest of 1 Corinthians, but didn't mean just that chapter, but we know full well that we have a great deal of respect for him, and there's no reason in this world why we shouldn't hold other single persons in great respect and honor as well. So we need to think of this one possibility and this one exception to the question of marriage, And we need also to support those people with the right kind of respect and honor that is due to them as those that God has specially gifted and given capacity to do that. You know, Paul mentions that gift in 1 Corinthians 7, too, where he says one has a gift of this sort and the other has a gift of that sort. One the gift of marriage, one the gift of the single life. And there are those passages that say it is good for a man not to touch a woman, and it is good for a man to be as I am, that is single, in 1 Corinthians 7. Now, how do you reconcile the second chapter of Genesis, verse 18, with 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul says it's good to be single, and where Moses says it's not good to be single? That seems like a direct contradiction, does it not? Well, let nobody hang you on that as a dilemma or a contradiction, because there is no contradiction whatever. Because one is the general rule and the other is the exception, and the scriptures are clear about that fact. If you read in verse 26 of 1 Corinthians 7, these peculiar circumstances in which Paul recommends the single life to all who can possibly follow it, you understand that this is the exception and not the rule. He says in verse 26, because of the impending crisis, it is my view that it is well for a person to remain in the state in which he is. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be released. Have you been released from a wife? Don't seek a wife. But if you do marry, there is no sin in doing so. And if a virgin marries, there is no sin in her doing so. However, you will have affliction in the flesh, and I am trying to spare you. What I am trying to tell you, brothers, is this: the time is short. From now on, let those who have wives be like those who have none, those who weep like those who don't weep, those who rejoice like those who don't rejoice, those who buy like those who have nothing, and those who use the world like those who abuse it. The shape of things in this world is giving way. What Paul is talking about is the fact that there was a bloodbath that was immediately impending. Paul was a prophet, and he had been told by God what was going to happen, and he even writes about it in some of his letters. And he was talking about that terrible persecution that the Roman world was going to bring, the Roman Empire was going to bring upon the church. And he saw that Christians would be thrown into the arena with unfed lions. He saw that Christians were going to be, whether he knew the details at that point or not, but he knew some kind of a bloodbath that eventually had these details to it, that Nero would take Christians and dip them in pitch and tie them to poles and put the poles up in his garden and ignite them as torches while wild orgies went on in the light of smoldering and flickering Christians burning on these poles. He knew that this kind of stuff was going to happen. And what he said was that in the light of this impending crisis that's right around the next corner, it would be better not only that you don't marry, but even that those who are married act as if they weren't. Now, he didn't mean all the wrong things about that, but he meant, this is an emergency situation. You've got to act in accordance with this emergency that's about to take place, this crisis that's about to come upon you. And so he's talking about a critical period where the time is short and the crisis was impending. It was hanging over their heads and ready to burst like a cloud on them. And in that situation, he says, it's in view of the present crisis, it's well for a person to remain as you are and as he was. So there's no contradiction between Genesis 2:18 and 1 Corinthians 7:26 and the rest of those passages in 7 that extol virtues of celibacy in a time of crisis. Paul does go beyond that and also speak of some of the values of celibacy as well, in helping to strengthen this argument, but the basic argument is in the light of that impending crisis. And there's no question today that the rule still persists that most of us should be married, because marriage meets a fundamental need in our lives, the need for companionship. We will be lonely without a companion, and we need companions, and God made us so that we could only find the fulfillment in life that we must have to do our work properly and so on with a companion, working together with that companion in whatever it is, and the help of that companion in life. And this is the rule for most of us, but there are exceptions to the rule for two reasons. First of all, God singles out some, Matthew 19, for special works in the kingdom who are to remain single and who will be able to do peculiar works for God's kingdom because of it. And they ought not go out and get as much money as they can in all kinds of other careers, incidentally. They ought to go find their place in the kingdom of God and really further it. And secondly, there are times and periods of crisis, bloodbaths in various places of the world today, where it'd be better for Christians not to get married and then the husband be slaughtered because of his faith, and children starved to death, and wives at the mercy of their captors, and all that kind of thing. It would be better if they weren't married, and those children didn't have to go through those ordeals, and the families didn't have to face those difficulties as a result of a marriage that might have been might not have taken place because of the crisis of following these words about a crisis period. If a crisis were to come upon us in a peculiar place in the world where we are, then 1 Corinthians 7 would become quite pertinent to us once again. Not that this is a dead letter. It is, I'm sure, quite pertinent to Christians who have read it in various parts of the world who were in impending crises of the same sort. So these are things, then, that we need to keep in mind, that marriage is the rule, but in times of crisis there's an exception, and in persecution there's an exception, and for certain people there are exceptions to that rule. All right, now just that little side excursus on that question, but I think it's important to say because there's so much false teaching about celibacy in so many quarters today. Now, the reason then, the basic and fundamental reason or rule for marriage is found in Genesis 2:18. It is not good for the man to be alone. Marriage then was instituted and continues in God's providence to bring about companionship. Companionship is the opposite or positive side of the problem of loneliness. And it's interesting that in the scriptures, companionship is what we see that marriage is described as bringing. In Proverbs, the second chapter, for instance, we are told that we're speaking here about the strange woman, or whatever you want to call her there, but the strange woman who forsakes, verse 17, Proverbs 2:17, forsakes the husband of her youth. Strange woman, probably because she was a stranger to Israel. A harlot had no place in Israel. She was to be stoned, and an adulteress was to be stoned, and so these were probably largely heathen women and therefore called strange women. But the strange woman, the adulteress who forsakes the husband of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. The interesting thing is that the word husband of her youth, and if you have the New American Standard, translates it, the companion of her youth. The word there is a word that can mean companion. It's a word that has to do with taming animals at some points. And that's not the concept here or the thought here, I don't think, though that at times might be appropriate, I suppose. But hardly is the wife given that role or the husband that role. But the idea is of someone that becomes, as the animal becomes close to you when it's tamed and becomes related to you in that taming process, and an intimacy grows up, and a friendship or a companionship develops. Those are the connotations and denotations of this word. The idea of closeness, developing closeness. And that's part of the idea of companionship, and I think companionship is a better translation than the Berkeley, which I was reading at this point, as you find it there in your New American Standard Version, who forsakes the companion of her youth, or the intimate one. Throughout the book of Proverbs, the same word is used to speak about how gossip separates intimate or close friends or companions, people who were once very close to each other, is the idea. The wild animal is not close to you, but the tame animal is one that's close to you. Well, this is the idea, one that you build up a relationship to. Build a relationship to geese flying in the sky or something. Now, we also read about this companionship concept in Malachi, where the word is even more closely related to that idea, though the first certainly is. In Malachi 2:14, God was refusing to accept the offerings of his people, though they had covered the altar with tears and sighing and all kinds of superficial and outward shows and evidences of piety, which were not really evidences at all. God refused to accept their pious attitudes, because down in their hearts, or the inner core of a man's being, which is what the heart in the scriptures mean. By the way, the word heart in the scripture never means the feelings as it does in our society. It's very important as you study the scriptures, because the word heart probably occurs more than any other term that has to do with the inner life of man, that you don't read into heart the word feelings. A lot of modern writers who write in counseling and so on read their modern concept of heart into the biblical text, and it never has that concept. They read feelings into it. That isn't what heart means at all. When it says that you're to do things with all your heart, all your mind, body, soul, and strength, or something of that sort, or you give your whole heart to something, it doesn't mean that you're to give all your feelings to it. But it means that you are to be genuine, sincere, earnest, that you are not just to be saying it or doing it on the outside, but you're to say or do it inwardly. The heart is the core or the innermost being of the man. This is just a little side. We might get into it later on at some point. It's the innermost being, the inner life of the person. And always in the scriptures, you never find our modern distinction between head knowledge and heart knowledge. That isn't a biblical concept at all. It's never the head and the heart that are contrasted in the scriptures. It's the lips and the heart, or the mouth and the heart, or talk and the heart, or outward appearances and the heart, or outward actions and the heart. It's always the outward and the heart being the inward. And it's that inward life where decisions and plans and thought and feelings and all of the inner life of the man is. The heart comprehends the whole business. It's the inner man. His inner life is inner being. And I don't know what that has to do with anything I'm saying here, but that's what the heart is anyway. And, the idea was that they were weeping and sighing outwardly. This was all outward stuff. But their whole inner being was opposite to what those sacrifices and what those tears and that weeping, the rest of it, were supposed to represent before God. And we know that the scriptures say, man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks upon the feelings? No, the heart. He looks upon the inner man, what he's really thinking and really like inside. We have no right to try to judge men's motives, but God does it. His motives are down in his heart. His conscience is down in his heart. His real planning, his real being, his real person is down in that heart. All right, so you say why? God asked in verse 14. I'll tell you why. All right, here it is now. Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, although she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Now, here is the word companion. And this is the word that has as its core and its basic meaning the idea of union or association or companionship, as we say. Both words are words for companionship. They're different words, but they are words that both express two sides of the same thought. Somebody with whom you can build a relationship. Can't build a relationship with a wild animal, but you can with a tame one somebody with whom you can build a relationship, and somebody with whom you associate and with whom you are united, who is with you. The idea of being with is in this second word used here in Malachi 2:14. So in both passages that we've mentioned here, the concept of the companion of your youth comes forth. In one place, it's the wife who's the companion of the youth. In the other place, it's the husband who is the companion of the wife's youth. And so both are called the companion of the other, and it's clear then that the passage in Genesis 2:18 does not speak only of the man's loneliness being met by companionship in marriage, though that was the original institution and impulse for the creation of the woman, but it's also true that the woman's need for companionship is met in marriage according to these passages in Proverbs and in Malachi. So the basic and fundamental element in marriage is companionship. And we need to say that. And we need to say that plainly. And we need to say that again and again and again and again in our evangelical circles, because no matter how often you say it, there will still be people who will pop up and say marriage is in order to propagate the human race. Or in one way or another, not saying it in these words, they will let you know that their basic idea is that marriage is to legitimize sexual relations. But that is not the basic element in marriage. That's very important when it comes to divorce issues. We will see how as we go along. But come back to all this as we get going, and as we come back to various issues. But right now, start laying them out, and we'll then start using these principles a bit as we build on them. It is very important to see this. Now, how can we be sure that this is so? Well, there are many ways in which we can begin to develop this. I've tried to make it clear that companionship is the basic element. But I will come back to that companionship theme in a few moments. But I'd like now just to turn for a moment to the idea of engagement in the Bible.